The Ministry of Defense, which he joined in 1985. He's had many different postings and has undertaken a fascinating series of jobs within the Ministry of Defense, including working in the Joint Operations Center during the Gulf War, where he was a briefer in the Air Force Ops Room. He's also been involved in work on the crisis in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's a senior executive officer, which is a civilian grade equivalent to the military rank of lieutenant colonel. Between 1991 and 94, he was posted to a division called Secretariat Air Staff and was given the job of researching and investigating the UFO phenomenon, mirroring the work done in the United States by the now defunct Project Blue Book. And although most of the cases could be explained as misidentifications of known objects and phenomena, a hard core of sightings defied any conventional explanation. Strong evidence emerged suggesting the presence of structured craft capable of speeds and maneuvers beyond the capability of even the most advanced prototype craft operated by the Royal Air Force or the United States Air Force. Joining us on the phone from his home in the United Kingdom, for which we are very grateful because it's very late on Saturday night, early Sunday morning, 2:37 in the UK, is Nick Pope. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Hello, thank you very much.
It's good to have you there. It's not many of our British confreres who would care to stay up and talk to us on the radio here in North America at this time of the morning.
Always and happy to do so for the
for the colonials.
Such an interesting subject. I wasn't going to say that.
No, I know you weren't, but it leapt to mind. Victor Vigiani is here in studio. You met him when you were down in Washington. He rounded you up for this program, which was real good of both of you. You're still in the ministry and still able to talk about things, which I guess a lot of our listeners would find remarkable.
Well, yeah, that's right. I've signed the Official Secret Act, so of course everything that I say must be unclassified. But there's certainly no difficulty with my talking about the UFO project in reasonably specific terms, not least because in line with the government policy on openness, there is increasing information about this now being made public.
It seems that way. Any specifics that come to mind immediately, Nick?
Well, there's the very famous Bentwaters case, of course. The entire file on that incident is now actually posted up on the Ministry of Defense website because the government was just getting so many inquiries about it, they decided that they had to release it. And, of course, we've got our own Freedom of Information Act, which is just coming into force. It has to be fully in force across all public bodies on 1st of January 2005. But in advance of that, government departments have to proactively publish any information which they think is likely to be requested a lot.
And now Stuart Miller is a monthly contributor to this program. He's our British correspondent. And he was quoting some outrageous amount of money to be able to get information under the British Information Act. He said it was outrageously expensive.
I'm not sure that the charging regime has been fully agreed yet. I think that will apply if you wanted a phenomenal amount of information. But for people who just want to access something that is readily findable, I don't think there's going to be a problem at all. And of course, as I was saying, the other point is that the government must put up onto the internet information which lends itself to being published in that way under what's called the publication scheme. And of course, that's an entirely open and free website.
How much information, other than the Bentwaters and the Rendlesham cases, do you figure that the British government has that it's willing to release?
Oh, there's absolutely stacks of it. At the moment, if you go to our National Archive at the Public Record Office in Kew, there are probably between 30 and 40 files which are open to the public. You can turn up there and browse through them to your heart's content and take photocopies. But there are probably another 150 files which have not yet been made public at all, because at present we operate to something called the Public Records Act. And until that's replaced, that means that generally the files that you have access to will only be ones that are over 30 years old. So all the more recent UFO material is not yet available, but it will be from next year.
There are 40 cases that are going to be released, and you figure another 150 that haven't been talked about at all or are still under wraps?
That's about right, but not cases. Uh-huh. I'm talking about entire files. So a file may well have several hundred different papers on it relating to many different cases. The British government received, in some years, as many as 750 UFO reports, although the average was much lower. It's now running at about 200 or 300 reports a year.
Do you know if there was any trading of information between the British and United States governments over the years?
There was a little, not as much as you might have expected, but when the British government were actually setting up our UFO project in 1950, we, of course, got alongside the United States Air Force and the people that had been doing Project Sign and Project Grudge, and we modelled what we did very much on Project Blue Book research efforts. And over the years, on occasion, there was low-level exchange of information. It was little more than, letting us know the sort of headline findings.
I guess the difference between the United States Air Force Project Blue Book and the British government's UFO investigation is that the British government's UFO investigation is still ongoing, huh?
That's correct, although I have a feeling that at the moment it's geared much more towards preparing for the Freedom of Information Act, and it's looking at issues of information management rather than the bread and butter research and investigation, which I was doing 10 years ago when I was heading it up. The other difference, of course, is that our project was rather more small scale.
I guess you were probably the only guy in the organization.
Yeah, I had some help.
You were the highest profile member of that organization, and probably as far as most UFO researchers were concerned, it was just you.
Yeah, that's correct. That was very much the public face.
Yeah. In studio with me, Victor Vigiani, on the line from his home in the United Kingdom, is Nick Pope.
I just want to take us back to the days of the conference there in Washington, Nick. That was a great piece of work that you did. I really enjoyed your presentations and our talks afterwards.
Well, thank you very much. It was an honor to be there, and I think the X Conference was a truly historic gathering of people.
I do agree with you. It was, in fact, a historic event. I just want to find out from you, with all the information that you indicated earlier that is sort of laying around and sort of waiting to be uncovered, is there some sort of sense of anticipation by the Ministry of Defense as to the kinds of requests that they're going to be getting and the kinds of responses that they're going to be forced to put forward in terms of the massive amount of information that must be held there?
There certainly is a realization that when looking at the vast range of subjects that the Ministry of Defense deals with, that requests for UFO information are going to be very popular. And the proof of that is the publication scheme that I was mentioning earlier. There's a lot of information already up on the Ministry of Defense's website, but statistical analysis of the number of hits shows that the UFO information is very much one of the favorites. So the department knows that this subject is going to be popular.
In that sense, you know, the UFO sightings and requests for information, is there any protocol in terms of what your air traffic controllers and pilots, be it commercial, private, or whatever, is there any protocol that they have to follow in order to present information that they may have reported and seen a sighting or at least reporting something at the target in some sort of anomalous way? Is there any kind of protocol there that they have to follow?
Yes, and there pretty much has been since the 1950s. And essentially, it's a mandatory reporting system. Any uncorrelated target, whether it's a visual one that military personnel have seen or whether it's an uncorrelated radar target that an air traffic controller or a fighter controller assesses as being a real contact, then that should be documented. And as ever with government and the military, there's a form to fill in, and it's not dissimilar from the old forms that Project Blue Book used to use for the recording of information. So much of what is going to be released is going to be on a standard form, and it's going to list all the obvious things, the date and time of the incident, description of what was seen, estimations of elevation above the ground, speed, color, any sound, things like that.
I noticed that that kind of information is sort of sequestered someplace, or at least behind some sort of secrecy process. I noticed that in some of the publications that you've got on your website, there have been questions put forward in Parliament about UFOs, and I know that there has been some dialogue and questions asked in Parliament about crop circles. Not necessarily talking about the information per se, but how does this stuff get to the lower Parliament? What generates that kind of interest?
It can come either from members of the public engaging with their representatives and asking them to raise this issue on their behalf, and some of them are happy to do so and reflect the questions that come from their constituents, and some are perhaps a little bit reluctant that it might lead them to a bit of ridicule. But some members of our parliament, past and present, have had a strong interest themselves. The classic example is the late Lord Hill Norton, who sadly died earlier this year. He, from the House of Lords, raised numerous questions about the UFO phenomenon, and in particular the Bentwaters incident from 1980.
I could say that it would be easy, but it seems to be the facilities with which members of Parliament can actually broach the issue seems to be something that's relatively easy to do, whereby here in our Parliament, here in Canada, and even the, I guess in Congress in the United States, is something that's very, very difficult. There seems to be a lot of undertow at work to keep these kinds of questions from the floor. I'm sort of wondering why the difference.
I don't know. I mean, as far as I understand the process, a question has to be delivered in advance to the office of the Speaker, and provided there's no good reason why it should be asked, like it's an obvious issue of national security about a particular intelligence operation or something, and provided it falls within the remit of a particular Department of State, then the Speaker's office will allow it to go forward.
No, it's just that I made a request to the same kind of process here for Freedom of Information, Access to Information, as we call it here. I received 117 pages, and I've been in contact with my Member of Parliament, and it's been very, very difficult to have him even consider the issue. And I'm just trying to rack my brains and trying to figure out why the difference of an elected representative in the UK would take this forward in a way to bring it right to the floor, and in someone here in Canada with, to my mind, would be much more information, become that much more reluctant to bring it forward. And I don't know, it just seems to be a really interesting contrast in the way our parliaments work.
I suspect it's personality-driven. I suspect that here in Britain, although there are quite a few questions that have been asked, there may well be representatives who have been approached but who have been reluctant.
And I think it's even the same with your media, too, isn't it? There seems to be some kind of facility with which your media covers these stories, whereby here in Canada and the United States, that you get the odd story in the paper and then it just becomes a, you know, fish wrap the next day.
Certainly at local level, there's probably a UFO story every day. And it's mainly local sightings, of course.
Mm.
But there's a fair degree of coverage from the nationals, including not just UFO sightings, but alien abduction reports, crop circles, of course, over the summer. I guess that lends itself to the media because, of course, it's a nice visual story,
mm-hmm.
which they like. But, yeah, there's never been any problem. Sometimes the media will pulling itself in different directions, shall we say. You'll get one newspaper article talking about a whole range of sightings and how interested it is, and then you'll have perhaps a more debunking argument in another newspaper. Again, I think it's personality-driven.
Does the British media get into the little green men syndrome the way that they do in North America? They can't resist. They always bring in little green men somewhere, whether the story is pro or con.
Yes, it does happen in many articles, but not all. But that's where I think there is a responsibility upon those ufologists who have a media profile to really effectively sort of sell their subject and not to get into an argument about it, to understand the way that the media work and to kind of roll with the punch, as it were,
mm-hmm.
but to try and present the best information, the good radar visual cases, and the truly unexplained sightings.
Unfortunately, it seems that when media is presented with a lot of the better information, they tend to go for the foolishness, much more content to deride the subject than spend too much time looking into it. It's just easier to dismiss.
And yet, of course, this is, as many people would probably acknowledge, the story of the century, if not considerably longer time frame than that. There are some journalists who are really prepared to get into the weed and look at the data and produce some really positive articles. It varies.
we could perhaps touch on the state of British ufology. Has it turned into a bunch of guys sitting at home with a nice cup of tea in the morning and doing their UFO research at the computer the way it seems to have done in North America?
Well, there are still people who are getting out there and getting into the field, sometimes literally. And in fact, earlier today, though unfortunately I had to work so I couldn't get there, but Larry Warren was back in Rendlesham Forest.
Oh, that's right. I remember posting something about that to the UFO updates list, yes.
Yes, I think probably, who was it? Max Burns, I think, posted something about that.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what happened was that Larry gave a lecture at the Bentwaters Base Theatre, and then he led a guided tour into the forest. And I'm pretty sure that this will have ended up with a Skywatch of some description. Certainly I know that people like Brenda Butler, one of the original investigators of this incident, are still out there in the forest on a regular basis investigating strange things that they are still seeing to this day.
Those things have been going on apparently for hundreds of years. There have been all kinds of strange things going on in those forests.
That's correct. One of the more recent but very thorough investigators of this case, Georgina Bruni, who wrote a book on it called You Can't Tell the People, she found from her historical research that it certainly wasn't just a question of Burroughs, Peniston, Kavanaugh, Charles Holt, the rest of the crew in 1980, that, as you say, this actually goes back hundreds of years and all sorts of strange phenomena been witnessed.
Described as ghosts for a couple of 300 years, and demons and strange flying things.
That's correct. And interestingly, during the Second World War, some of these ghost stories came to the fore, and it was thought that the ghost of a German airman downed during the fighting was regularly seen in the area. You know, many of the United States Air Force personnel who've served there, long before the UFO incident, testified that it was a very, very spooky place.
Yeah, it's not the kind of place that I would care to spend any length of time after dark.
I've done some filming up there, and I suppose you could say that being in any forest after dark could be a bit creepy, but
mm-hmm.
there really is something quite phenomenally spooky and weird about this place, I have
mm-hmm.
to say. Now, there are lots of people actually getting out there and going on sky watches and seeing whether they can see something. It's not all internet-based, which is a good thing.
What is it about this sighting, this event, Nick, that it just seems to be coming up over and over again? That case just doesn't seem to want to go away. A lot of times these stories just sort of fade into oblivion, but this story just keeps on rearing its head every once in a while. Different perspectives keep on coming out, different little bits of information. What is it about this story that really makes it potentially really a mind-blower in ufology?
Well, I think it's the fact that more witnesses are coming forward, even to this day, and I think having just said that ufology isn't all about the internet. The internet is an absolutely phenomenal tool for doing research. And I mean, the military, of course, are very hot on things like reunions and getting in touch with former colleagues. And there are a number of websites where the military get together, and those that served at Bentwaters and Woodbridge are increasingly, through the internet, coming forward and finding other people who witnessed the UFO, and then maybe people who haven't said anything are thinking, well, I've got a part of that story to tell too. But I think one of the other interesting things was that when Georgina Bruni wrote her book on it, for the first time, she'd managed to track down and interview General Gordon Williams, who was the base commander at the time. So I think there was a feeling that once the base commander had spoken out on this, the guy in overall charge, Charles Holt's boss, once the top guy had spoken out, I think anyone who felt that, well, maybe I shouldn't talk about this, thought, well, if the general's talking about it now, I guess I can.
Did the general, in fact, corroborate the sighting that happened by various members of the security police there at the base and Colonel Holt himself when he went off into the forest to investigate what it was that the Air Force police were reporting to him? Did the general confirm all of that?
Well, to be fair to him, he didn't see anything himself,
mm-hmm.
and he certainly doesn't have any truck with some of the more bizarre stories about him going out into the forest and meeting with extraterrestrials. Hmm. He says that that just didn't happen.
Yeah.
So in a sense, he doesn't really corroborate anything except that clearly something happened and that some of his people saw something and reported it. So he isn't really a direct player in this, except insofar as he was the base commander, and so of course he was aware that something had happened.
And Colonel Charles Holt was obviously a very reliable man. He wouldn't have been a colonel, he wouldn't have been in the position that he was on a United States Air Force base where there were tactical nuclear weapons involved.
Well, Holt's a pretty regular guy and, like you say, not prone to flights of fancy, I think. By his own admission, he said that when he first heard about all this, he said, well, when they said that the UFO came back, he said he went out into the woods, in his words, to debunk it, to see if he could debunk it. And he didn't really expect to become part of the incident itself.
Any interesting cases that have come up of late in the UK that have attracted your attention, Nick?
I was telephoned just, I think, on Thursday or Friday, I can't recollect, by a newspaper from Wales who said that they had been sent a very interesting video. Now, I've not seen this yet, but apparently some people captured something on video and it was there for some considerable time. Now, sometimes when you zoom in on an object, as you know, it can distort, and particularly if you're quite excited, it can be apparently moving around quite rapidly. But it sounds an interesting piece of footage, and with the rise of camera phones and camcorders and such like, I think we're going to see more and more people bringing images forward, and our technological ability to perhaps analyze them is something which will also improve. So I think that's a good thing for ufology.
Nick, I tried to read that Pravda news story on Tunguska as part of the news that we do at the opening of this program earlier on tonight, and I suddenly realized I hadn't got a clue what those words meant. It just got more and more convoluted, totally lost in the translation. What do you make of this Tunguska thing and Pravda being a trashy tabloid?
It's quite a turnaround from what Pravda used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly this story, even here in the UK, has generated a lot of publicity that this expedition to Siberia has reportedly recovered something of whatever it was that fell in Tunguska on 30th of June 1908 and flattened such a vast area of the Siberian forest. Now, the Pravda story that this is apparently something from an extraterrestrial craft, we'll wait and see. I'm skeptical of that. I'm glad that somebody has actually gone and mounted an expedition. Now, whether they've found a piece of meteorite or whatever, I don't know. I suppose it's now up to the scientists.
And there was this other silly story that's connected with that that suggested that aliens had saved the Earth by ramming into the meteorite and causing it to explode over Siberia rather than headed into the densely populated European areas further along its path.
That is a little bizarre, but I think there is a serious issue here. I'm involved in something called Space Guard UK as an associate member, and it's a group that lobbies to raise the awareness in government, media and the public about the threat that the Earth does face from comets and asteroids. It's a chilling thought that if whatever exploded over Tunguska had arrived a little earlier or later, it might have hit a major populated area, and it certainly, whatever it was, and I think my favorite theory out of many is that it was a small comet or a fireball that just burned up and exploded in the air, undeniably with the force of several atomic bombs.
They're devastated for many, many, many square miles in all directions, a forest there. I mean, those old pictures of that area with the trees flattened in a circle from a central blast area. It's quite remarkable.
Yes, I mean, this is
the
light. I remember back in the 70s, there were quite a few books on this mystery, and there were various bizarre theories doing the rounds, including one intriguing idea that a small piece of antimatter had been involved. But I think you can pick your theory with this sort of thing.
It will be interesting to see if the team that is up there actually find any physical evidence of something that had one time exploded there. But the light from that and the concussion was felt as far away as London, I understand.
That's correct. I mean, contemporary media stories, which still survive, of course, in the archives, talk about strange lights and glows and such like. So, yeah, there certainly was an event, and it was celestial of one sort or the other. Whether it was extraterrestrial or not, I don't know. I mean, as I say, according to the Pravda story, the expedition do claim to have actually discovered something which they say is a bit of a craft, but, you know, we'll see what mainstream science has to say about a proper analysis of this.
I have to say, I'm not holding my breath here in Toronto, you know.
No, nor am I, to be honest, but it's an interesting story, and it'll get people thinking again about certainly one of the most intriguing mysteries of the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. So, to come back up to date and into the near future, what's next on the agenda for Nick Pope?
Well, I've been involved with just helping on the methodology and helping identify some participants in a scientific study that's going on over here into the alien abduction phenomenon. And this is mirroring the sorts of work done by people like McNally and Clancy in the States. What the study, which is based at Goldsmiths College, University of London, is trying to do is to take people who claim to have had abduction experiences and actually give them psychological tests and tests of psychic ability, interestingly, and then match that against a control sample of people claiming no such experiences. Now, that study's been going on for much of this year. I think currently they're looking at the data and hopefully going to publish something in a month or two.
Well, that'll be interesting to see. Are they speaking strictly to British subjects, or are they expanding their research?
No, this is purely a UK-based study, as much for the practical reasons as anything else. Mm-hmm. They need to obviously speak to everyone face-to-face.
Actually, interesting to see the correlation between those that believe they've been abducted and the increase in the paranormality in their lives. Because you hear all kinds of stories about people becoming amazingly psychic, at some people being able to heal, people who could never draw stick men properly suddenly becoming amazing artists as a result of their experiences.
I think those are two separate issues. In my own work with abductees, I certainly agree that there is a marked transformation in people's lives. I suspect a psychologist would say that any profound event is going to have such a transformative effect.
Right.
But yes, some people do develop artistic interests and skills, as you say, poetry, art. Some people get involved in environmental issues. The psychic thing is I think, separate, and that's what's going to be tested. And, of course, it is scientifically testable, which it's a good thing that this is happening.
Mm-hmm. When that comes out, I'd love to have you on, or perhaps somebody, you know, involved in the study on my Sunday night program.
Yes, the good thing would probably be to get Professor Chris French, who's the scientist who's actually undertaking this work.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can speak about whether he'd be prepared to come on to the show and talk about his results.
Yeah, that would be good. And of great interest to people who listen to CFRB 1010 on Sunday nights. The program's called Mind Shift. Nick Pope, I want to thank you for staying up this late on your Saturday night and trust that you can have a bit of a lie-in tomorrow.
I'm going to get a few hours sleep now.
Well, good. Thank you for being with us tonight. It's always good talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again in the not-too-distant future.
Thank you very much.
Good night, Nick.
Good night.